From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Those of you listening in the Salt Lake Valley, as you're staring out the window at the gunk that has settled in, remember there are people around the world staring out their windows, fretting in the same way you are about the air. Throw a dart at a world map, and there's a good chance you'll land on a place that has polluted air. Like Wales in the UK. According to the BBC, air pollution contributes to 2,000 deaths in Wales every year. 2,000. But of course, that's nothing compared to China or India, which has in the neighborhood of 1 million deaths a year related to bad air. The point is, this is a global problem, and today on the program, we're talking about it. But not just the problem, the solutions people in these places are working out. What do you do about this bad air? Join us after the news. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio, and it's time for another screening in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. On Thursday, not Wednesday, we're screening filmmaker James Redford's film about renewable energy. Redford went on this quest to learn more about renewable energy, and what he wanted to know was, do we have the capability to replace fossil fuels, and do we have the will? The film is called Happening. Join us at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center Thursday night at 7. This is Radio West, I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's easy to find the problem of dirty air. This time of year, you can see it. On a day like today, you can practically touch it. And by now, here in Salt Lake City and along the Wasatch Front, we know why there's a problem. We live in a valley that traps cold, bad air. And we have too many vehicles on the roads, which we also have industries and businesses that pollute. We don't have enough public transportation or a culture willing to use it. What's harder to figure out, because of the scope of all of those problems, is what to do about it. At the BBC, they've started this new initiative that takes a different approach to covering stories. Rather than focused on just the problem, it has shifted the focus to covering the solution. Earlier this year, this project, they've come to call it Solutions Focused Journalism, or SFJ, has been looking at air pollution around the world. Because it can be easy to forget we're not the only ones suffering through red air days. So today in the program, we've asked Emily Casriel to join us to talk about the BBC's reporting and to say something about this new approach to these stories. Emily Casriel is head of editorial partnerships and special projects at the BBC World Service Group. Earlier this year, she served as editor of a number of these stories looking at air pollution around the world. That series was called So I Can Breathe. And she's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in London. And Emily, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
That's really great to be with you, Doug, and all your listeners. Thank you so much.
Well, let me pose a couple of questions to get the listeners engaged if they want to. We want to hear from you. What ideas maybe do you have for dealing with air pollution that you've come across? You know, not so much the problems as much as the solutions may be focused today. What steps, for example, are you taking to protect yourself and your family? Do you ever have that attitude that you just need to suck it up and deal with it? Is it too big a problem to even think about or worry about or find solutions for? Join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Okay, so Emily, before we jump into the air pollution part, I did want to ask you about this new approach to these stories, this solutions-focused journalism. You've said and written about that often the way that journalists frame and tell stories gives audiences kind of a distorted picture of the world, and you wanted to take a new approach. Explain, if you would.
Well, the way that journalists are instructed and trained and the way they think of news is often the big, bad stories, especially not when they're working on radio, when they're working on telly or video, TV, I should say, and video. They're looking for dramatic pictures. They're looking for dramatic change, something that hasn't happened before. And this dramatic change is often thought to be where there's something that happens that's catastrophic or very bad. Mm. And it's also part of what really motivates journalists, which is holding power to account. And they feel that they do this by pointing out to politicians or mayors or whoever's in charge about something bad that's happening in their neck of the woods. So, for example, I was leading a workshop with colleagues in the BBC Delhi Bureau, And they said to me, look, it's our job to point out what's going wrong in the slums around Delhi, because we're the voice of the voiceless. If we don't do that, who will? And with solutions-focused journalism, it's really pointing out to journalists that actually they're not telling a very accurate picture of the world by solely focusing on the bad news. And it's not just as the BBC or anybody else solely focuses on the bad news.
We all do.
But by also spending time looking for the solutions, looking for the ways that people are solving these problems day in, day out, we'll be giving a more complete picture of the world, and also one that gives audiences a better way that they can work out the risk of letting your kids play out, you know, outside in the streets. Because a lot of people think that the world is getting more dangerous, whereas in fact in the UK, a lot of violent crime has decreased over many years.
Well, that's one of the things you've written about, is the results of this kind of reporting, the focus that we've had as journalists, is this gap between what we believe is going on and reality. I mean, you mentioned playing in the streets. It's probably safer there. Child abductions is another one that comes to mind. There are fewer now, but we think there are more. That's our sense of reality, I guess.
And it's also because, you know, if you think of the way that we spent most of our evolutionary history on the savannah, we are trained, our brains are wired in order to be alert for danger. So we see danger, we're more likely to remember it, we're more likely to want to avoid it than we are attracted to eat red berries and the good things in life. Right. And therefore, we're more likely to remember them. Journalists are more likely to remember them, and our audiences are more likely to remember them. But recent research from the Reuters Institute in the UK at Oxford University has shown that a lot of people who really are not consuming news are not consuming it because they're fed up of the way that consuming news makes them feel. Yeah. And this is especially so amongst young people. I was actually on a road trip in Florida a couple of years ago with my kids, and I at the time had a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old, and we put a podcast of the BBC World Service News Hour because I work with the BBC. And my 14-year-old listened to her music, and my 16-year-old listened to the whole podcast, and it was a big story. I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago there were these Americans and French people on a train who overcame guys who were trying to create violence on this train. I don't know if you remember that story.
Sure.
And he just didn't say anything, but he listened to the whole hour. And then the next day, we put on another podcast, and it was about the European refugee crisis. And he said to me, oh, for God's sake, that's just so sad. There's nothing that I can do. Therefore, I'm not interested. Can you just bloody well turn it off, as we say in the UK?
Yeah.
And I just thought, what a strange kind of collection of things to say. There's nothing you can do, therefore you're not interested. I should say this minute, he is actually now in Tanzania doing some voluntary work with Operation Rally, so he's not all totally lost his way. But it was such a strange sort of collection. And then when I talked to our audience research team, that's what they were finding out time and time again amongst young people around the world. There was this sort of presumption that there could be something that could be done. And if there wasn't, therefore, they didn't really want to engage.
It's hard as a reporter to shake this grammar of news coverage, as you've described it. You tell the story of a reporting trip you took to Nigeria some time ago, where you were looking around and nothing seemed to be amiss. And so you figured in some ways there isn't really a story here.
Yeah, I remember that very keenly. I used to work many years ago with the African Service, and I was in Nigeria reporting elections. And this was the time the military were in charge, and it was really tense and a lot of violence and a lot of tension. And we went round, I was with a local reporter, and we went round to polling booths doing our job, trying to find the story. It was the day of the election that we could report live back to our colleagues in London and then back to the whole of Africa. And the BBC has a very big audience in Nigeria. We went to a polling booth and it was just all calm and it was all kind of straightforward. So I said, clearly, there's no story. Let's go find a polling booth where there is a story to tell. And I look back at myself as a kind of young, enthusiastic journalist and think, you know, what kind of a distorted picture was I telling when I was ignoring what was going right?
You know, I think it's important to point out, which you have, that this solutions-based approach is not naive. You're not attempting to ignore a problem. You're just taking a different approach to it. It's still journalism, and you're not being an advocate, by the way. I think that's another important way of talking about this approach.
Yeah, I'm grateful for you saying that, because at the BBC, and I'm sure, you know, similarly to a lot of public radio and a lot of journalism in the US, but for the BBC, it's absolutely integral to be impartial and independent, and that is the way that we're judged on all our reports. And therefore, I have to work very hard with my colleagues in this space, in solution-focused journalism, with more my mainstream news colleagues. And I'm working with different ones of them who are adopting this sort of approach in varying degrees, alongside more traditional news reporting, I should add, to tell them that we are not advocates. We're not a campaign. So when I was working on this season on air pollution, which we chose to call So I Can Breathe, because actually I have very mild asthma and I kind of wanted to make it personal to people. I didn't want it a kind of coming on high as a sort of technical scientific season. But it was really important that we look rigorously at solutions. So it's not about celebrating solutions. It's not about NGO puff pieces. It's not about just looking for the good guys and hero worshipping them. It's about looking at problems that people are having and looking at ways that people are solving that problem and applying the same sort of rigour that we would to any other story. And a crucial part of that is about looking and asking for evidence. And some states, sometimes the solution is at a very early stage and evidence doesn't exist. And then we need to share that and be transparent with our audiences, even if it makes a little more hesitant a story.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually, the fact that it, as reporters, if the evidence isn't in, if there hasn't been a scientific conclusion, if you think we back away from a story, you tell, for example, about this Russian architect, the reporting during this series, who has this idea of this skyscraper that could clean the air surrounding it. Now, it's really early in the technology, so there's no actual evidence that these kinds of things make a difference yet. And I'm wondering if that's an obstacle to reporting on it yet, because the word isn't exactly in. It's not solved.
It's a really interesting question. And I was working closely with academics to kind of help me be able to judge stories and have a clearer sense of what was and wasn't working, because they were more in touch with the evidence base. And remember, of course, there's lots of different types of scientific evidence. Yeah. There's rarely a definitive yes and no on many questions. But in terms of smog sucking pollutants, you know, the jury was not just as much out, but pretty skeptical. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean that in the future technology won't be developed that will be able to sort of suck smog out effectively. But so far, it's pretty skeptical. But we decided that we wanted to include the story in our season, but with a lot of provisos. So it's almost more about showing that people are using their creativity in an attempt to tackle the problem, even if it's not very successful. The other thing you must remember, of course, that some solutions, like this architect's idea, which was still only a piece of paper, it hasn't actually been built. Right. But when these things are built, they can act as very important awareness raising. Because, of course, politicians, if they are going to make changes, need to feel that the majority of people feel that it's a problem that needs to be solved. Mm. And awareness raising projects, even though they don't in themselves curb air pollution, can be important in the grand scheme of things.
Okay, before we shift into the conversation about bad air, I did want to ask you one more thing. One of the things about the project is that you say you challenge the portrayal of people as passive victims, like that they're incapable of responding in positive ways. Is that one of the characteristics of our coverage? Sometimes we get caught up in looking at people as more victims than engaged players in something?
I think absolutely it is, and particularly of news, and particularly important for the World Service Group, which reaches over 300 million people every week across the world in coming up to 40 languages. So we're working, you know, reaching audiences. And when we let's say, talk about disaster, because, of course, disasters, whether it's earthquake or a flood or those sorts of stories, they're big, they're sexy, they've got dramatic pictures, nice volcanoes. And what we do is we look for the drama. So we come and report upon something really horrible that's happened, let's say an environmental disaster like the ones I've described. And then we want to show how it's infecting people. So we talk to people who say, oh, you know, it's really terrible. This has happened to me. I've lost my child, or, you know, whatever disaster has struck. And those are those dramatic pictures that we have, that we often portray people in that way as victims in the developing world. But, you know, the vast majority of people in a situation like that aren't going to be relying on handouts, whether locally or coming from the West. They're going to be relying on their own networks. They're going to be relying on neighbours. They're going to be getting by in all sorts of ways and developing their own resilience and their own very low cost, very local solutions, often using frugal innovation and now increasingly using cell phones, which are accessible to people in many, many countries. And it's that local innovation that I think is really important. And that doesn't make big dramatic stories, but it's the ways that people are getting by. And by focusing on that type of frugal innovation, by doing stories on how people are coming together and sharing what resources that they have and sharing ideas, we're portraying people as, you know, agents of their own lives, which of course is what people are. And that's also good for us, good for them, and good for the people consuming the content. Because I think us just consuming content, seeing people as passive victims, that doesn't make us feel empowered either as consumers of news and stories.
Emily Casriel is with us. She's head of editorial partnerships and special projects at the BBC World Service Group. She served as editor of the BBC's So I Can Breathe series of stories about air pollution. We have a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. We're already starting to hear from some of you with some of these questions about how you're thinking about the solutions to the bad air that is afflicting us these days. You can join us again, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about bad air because the pollution here along the Wasatch Front is socked in right now. It's supposed to be this way for days. And it can be easy to forget we're not the only ones suffering. So we're taking the conversation global today, exploring how bad air is an issue in London and Egypt, in New Delhi. It's bad in China and Mexico and the French Alps, everywhere. Pretty much. Emily Casriel is with us, the head of editorial partnerships and special projects for the BBC World Service Group. They've been looking this year at the problem of air pollution around the world, and she's joining us from the BBC in London. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. Let's go to the phones. Greg is joining us in Salt Lake City. Greg, welcome.
Hi, Doug. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a daughter that was diagnosed with asthma, so this is an incredibly important topic for me. And I've been thinking about, I know that if you reduce the speed of your car, that you reduce the emissions that you have. And one of the solutions I would like to see implemented here in the Salt Lake Valley is that that we have mandatory speed restrictions on the interstates on really, really bad days. And I mean, we've got all of these electronic billboards out on above the interstate saying, you know, how long it's going to take us to get to, I don't know, Farmington, which is just north of Salt Lake. And then everyone starts to speed up thinking, oh, let's beat that speed. Well, if we just had something where we'd say reduce your speed to 60 and then and have that mandatory. And if somebody gets pulled over, they get a ticket for it. And then the other thing as well is I wanted to ask Emily a question about exactly how the congestion charge in central London works and how it might be implemented here in the Salt Lake Valley. The other thing that I was quickly thinking about while I was just waiting for this was that newer cars have these, when you stop, the car goes off. If there's any way to retrofit cars to have these on there and get a tax break for that to be able to to be able to reduce emissions. So that's all I got.
Good. Okay, well, that's a lot. Okay, good. And let's take a couple of those things first. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Emily, was Greg's, you know, he has a suggestion, some of the smaller things, that the things, the difference that might make. But let's start with Central London. How about that? Because this is something you're looking into, some of the efforts, for example, of the London mayor to deal with these low emissions zones. To talk about, start there maybe, and let's work through some of these questions.
Yeah, well, London is a really big problem. And I'm also really, I didn't know about Salt Lake City and the fact that you've got some of the worst air quality in the US before I was invited on this show. And first of all, you know, my sympathy, my empathy with you guys, because I didn't know that. And that sounds really, really terrible, especially because of your mountains and the inversion that you have. It's also interesting, of course, because today in Paris, it's the World Climate Summit, and leaders from the world are gathering together to deal with climate change. And what's interesting is that they're not all, but many of the measures that can be taken to reduce climate change also help with air pollution. And in fact, a lot of the groups who are working on climate change are also working on air pollution and realize that for many people, that's a bigger motivator for them to look about changing behaviors. So London does have really bad air pollution. And I cycled to work. It was freezing today, actually, unusually -3, but I decided to cycle and avoid the black ice. And I went in and I don't know, it's interesting, because it felt really clear, but also I didn't check the air pollution. Often when it feels clear, it isn't necessarily clear. It's interesting, Greg, that you mentioned speed bumps. I mean, you mentioned reducing your speed, sorry. But my understanding, reducing, is that if you sort of slow down and speed up, that can actually be worse for air pollution. It might be interesting for you to look at your car, because, of course, you're not protected inside your car. In fact, when you're inside your car, you're much more vulnerable to air pollution than when you're walking, and a lot of people don't know that. And it's certainly worth thinking about the way that, you know, the emissions from your own car. In fact, we have I bicycle to work and bicycle most of the time, but we also do have a car in our family, and it's a hybrid, and I used to be able to drive into London and not pay a congestion charge, but they've changed the rules now to do with the mayor's new low emission zones. Right. So it means only fully electric vehicles can drive into London and not pay the congestion charge. So, you know, those sorts of issues are one of the things that the mayor is considering, because the people in London feel, like you guys, really passionate about not wanting to breathe this very, very polluted air, given all the research that we know, how it's affecting us. And more research is becoming, you know, evidence-based in terms of the ways that these very minute particles, especially the PM0.1, the really tiny ones, go into our bloodstream. And there's some evidence that they can even enter our brains and cause dementia, although that's still very early stage, is my understanding.
So these low emission zones in the center of London, and even this these low emissions neighborhoods that the mayor has in mind, how are people reacting there? I mean, there's always the question of political will. I'm guessing there's some resistance. Do you see this thing moving forward?
I mean, there is some resistance from businesses who are concerned about delivery of their goods, because this also affects, you know, trucks and lorries who are delivering goods. And there's a concern that people won't come to these areas. But it's interesting. I mean, London is still so congested, even with the congestion charge. You know, the traffic is really bad. But they've also been creating, as part of this move, some really brilliant cycle lanes. And I was cycling to a BBC office, which is way out in sort of, well, for me, felt way out in East London. Because my usual commute's really nice and just through Regent's Park, which is lovely, on my bicycle. And yet they've got this fantastic new cycle superhighway, which is right next to the Thames. And it means that it's like being in Holland. You just don't have to think. You just get on your bicycle and just kind of, you know, next moment you're there without having to be amongst traffic. And that makes a lot of difference. Obviously very popular for cyclists, less popular for other road users who feel themselves to be more and more squashed. And that's part of the idea.
Greg, glad you called. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here's a note from Glenn, who writes, the solutions, be a one-car family, use an electric or a rotary lawnmower, live closer to work. He goes through a few of these, actually. Don't allow legislators to give polluters like refineries a pass on emissions limits, stop idling your car in the driveway. He says, it's just a start, but I have never lived somewhere so apathetic to something that is harming themselves and their children. Let me ask you about that final part of the sense that people are apathetic to this. I'm guessing people in other places feel the same way. What are you noticing about that? Do you have a sense that there is a kind of apathy among institutions and politicians in some places?
I think that there is a lot more listening that politicians are doing, is my sense, because, you know, I think the kind of the dial is shifting in this space, because I think because we can't see a lot of air pollution, it's sort of been unreported for decades. And if you think of some recent stories, for example, that some car manufacturers have found to be cheating when they do their air emissions tests, the fact that there's more evidence now for the health impacts of air pollution that we just didn't really know about before. And in the UK, for example, the government has lost some key court cases over illegally having this dirty air. So they've been forced. They didn't want to make these changes. They've been forced to make these changes. So I think, you know, in a way it's been underreported and now people are waking up to air pollution. And certainly, you know, when before I worked on this season, it's not something that I was aware of. Yeah. And since working on the season, I've now, we have an old Victorian house and, you know, we used to kind of occasionally light a log fire. Well, actually, our house is freezing. It's got radiators, but it's just still very cold, really cold. So it's just really nice to have a, you know, nice wood burning fire. But now I'm like really concerned about it because I realise I don't want to be contributing to air pollution in the city. And also just thinking of different routes I take. I mean, there's some things, for example, that you can do just to be a bit safer. If you're a pedestrian, for example, or in, you know, indeed somebody in a car. But if you're a pedestrian, when you're wanting to cross the road, if you take a step back while you're waiting for the cars to pass, that can make a difference. I mean, the big thing, of course, is to keep away from busy roads. The only problem if you're a car and all the, you know, people go onto smaller roads, then they too will become busy. But strollers are especially vulnerable because if you think when you're taking your kids in the car or when you're, you know, using a stroller, the kids' faces, of course, get the exhaust fumes directly in them. And it's important to watch out for hot spots where there's idling and tall buildings like Urban Canyon where all the wind, all the air pollution can go down. That's something. Another small thing you can do is when you're at a hill walking, it's important. I don't know how much you guys do walking in Utah, where everybody drives all the time.
We drive
like,
a lot.
I'm talking about a different planet.
Walk. Yeah.
Some of you walk. Okay.
Yeah,
you occasionally, I mean.
Yeah. Some of us are walkers, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I lived in America for a couple of years, many years ago, and I lived in New York, which was kind of, I couldn't drive at that stage. Yeah. And I found, you know, for me, being in a kind of car culture is a, you know, it's something very different. Yeah. Because people have different sense of community if you get in your car all the time. Whereas in London, even though, as I say, we do have a car, we don't use it very much. It's the normal thing is to walk or to cycle, at least for our family. But as I said, if you dare to get outside your car and walk on a hill, it's better to walk on the side where the cars are going down because you'll be less exposed to air pollution.
Wow. What did you find that one? I loved that one, actually. It's the small
things.
Yeah,
that's quite a nice one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's small things that you can do to protect yourself. But of course, other things that people are doing in some really polluted cities like Beijing and New Delhi is that they are taking precautions to help themselves, like more air filters and more air conditioning, which actually might cause air pollution to be worse for other people.
Right.
So I think it's really important to look how much you're protecting yourself and how much are you making the situation worse for others.
Around here, and I can't remember, I can't cite whether it was one particular person, if it was just an idea that was raised at some point about, what about big, massive fans? You put them, I don't even know what the plan was, where you would put them somewhere in the valley, and would that have any effect? Which kind of seems on its face absurd and maybe is. But one of the BBC reporters in this series had mentioned that, I think it was maybe in New Delhi, there's some effort to experiment with these big, massive jet engines. in terms of blowing air. What do you know about that?
My understanding, my recollection, is that that wasn't successful.
Right.
A lot of these ideas are not evidence-based. And again, if you think of the energy that would be consumed in creating such a fan, that causes real problems. But there's also other things that you can do because, you know, how well is your home insulated?
Yeah.
Because if you don't use so much heating, you're not only saving on air pollution, but also on cash and carbon emissions. And the wood-burning stoves, now they look so kind of cool and warm. I mean, not only having fires, open fires, like open fire, you know, in my house, but wood burning stoves. I don't know if you guys have them in Utah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I have to say, it's a good segue into the conversation about what's going on in the French Alps. We're contending with wood-burning stoves. We have actually restrictions in place right now. But in France, they're dealing with that. I hadn't thought about the French Alps as having bad air, but that was one of the areas you looked at in the series.
Yeah, because we looked at the Arno Valley, which about 150,000 people live there, and it's surrounded by some of the most famous, fantastic ski resorts like Chamonix. But they have a really bad time with fine and ultra-fine particles. And in fact, the area of the Alps has the worst fine particle pollution in France because you've got the mountains blocking the wind, I think a bit like you guys do. So similar to what I understand happens in Salt Lake City, you've got infant and primary schools where the youngest kids are kept inside at break time. And even the older kids aren't allowed to run around. And the reason is this wood-burning tradition. They also have diesel fumes from the Mont Blanc tunnel lorries, but the worst, you know, the biggest contributor to the problem is these wood burning stoves, so that you've got columns of smoke rising from many of the houses. And they think about 60 to 80% of fine particle pollution comes from these wood burning stoves and fireplaces. And what's kind of interesting from a place like, you know, in the Alps, is that on one hand they want to clean up their act, but on the other hand they kind of don't want to implement very drastic measures because they don't want to blacken the image of the ski resort, where people feel that they're going there to breathe fresh air. In fact, if you think about Greg, our last speaker was worried about his, you know, his daughter, I think, being diagnosed with asthma. People always say, you know, skiing is a good thing. But what they've done in winter last year, they did restrictions on the most polluting heavy goods vehicles, a voluntary slowdown of some industrial activity, and a decrease in the volume of refuse burning, and a ban on burning wood for households with alternative means of heating. But there are other people in that area who are lobbying for more drastic changes.
Here's an email from David, who writes, years ago at the University of Turin in Italy, they came up with an invention that was perfect for urban areas. They encased a thin layer of palladium into the concrete dome of a building. The idea was the UV light that was heating the surface was able to decompose air pollutants like a catalytic converter. Now, you don't need to comment on the particulars of that. I don't know whether that seems like viable science or not, but it does go to, we were mentioning earlier, the Russian architect who had this hyper filter, this skeleton and porous shells and long pipes with filters inside. How much of this kind of thinking is going on dealing with air pollution, have you found around the world?
There is thinking, because architects want to be part of the solution, and they often think creatively. That's the nature of their, you know, they are creative people and they want to look for really innovative solutions. But when I talked to academics working in this area, they were pretty skeptical. And it doesn't mean that we can't yet find solutions, but, you know, absorbing air pollution is a lot harder than reducing the emission of air pollution, which generally is what people feel where we should be concentrating on. And I should also say, it's not just man-made or people-made pollutants that are causing the problem. There's also natural causes of air pollution, like soil and dust and sand, which cause a great deal of air pollution, which is also really bad for people's health. And it's actually where these natural sources of pollution mix with more man-made, more people-made causes of pollution that you start to get some of the worst effects. So, for example, you get a lot of areas in some cities around in the outskirts in Africa which aren't paved. So you get the dust caused when vehicles go past, which then mixes with the pollutants from the vehicles, particularly very bad diesel emissions, which can cause really, really bad problems.
There's a story that you did in the part of the series. I think this was the BBC program World Hacks, with the story about in Shenzhen, China, where they have these low carbon parks where they have this mist that sprays into the air to remove the dust and to cool things down, these kind of low carbon cities. What do you know about that?
Yeah, that's a kind of really exciting idea. But it's an experiment. It's an experimental design, and it's part of a huge national series of experiments to try and tackle air pollution. Because Shenzhen, which is the city, actually, I was there, yeah, it's a couple 2 years ago. I don't know if many of your listeners know about it. It's a massive big industrial city just very, very near Hong Kong. And it's one of the 8 so-called low-carbon cities across China, which have been given a mission to bring down energy consumption. But as well as these experiments, they're also doing other measures which are a little bit more concrete. So, for example, it's the third largest port in the whole world, and ship pollution is a really big cause of air pollution. But ships entering the port now have to switch off their diesel engines and use clean energy that the port gets and sends them down via a cable. They're also operating cranes with electricity. I believe that they're the first port in the world to do so. And they're also closing down polluting industries. They use a lot of electric buses and taxis. Actually, electric vehicles are really big throughout China, and they're very, very heavily subsidized. But of course, using electric vehicles doesn't really help the whole problem, because it can then move air pollution from the cities where the vehicles are to the coal power stations, and there's still a lot of them in China. But what was interesting from that program that came out from the Local Environment Commission, that the really big reason that they're having success in Shenzhen isn't all these great measures, isn't a technology, but is strong enforcement of the regulations. So they have implemented much more strict measures that are even more demanding than the national standard, in order that, you know, anybody who is who doesn't listen to these instructions, and they have a lot of supervisions, a daily focus on supervision and inspection. So anybody who breaks these protocols and laws will get punished severely.
I think that's the lesson I took from that series you did on China, was what's important here is that the government is empowering these city level officials to lead this fight, that they're going really local, they're getting really strict. It seems like a really decent model for people.
It is very interesting, because a lot of cities, a lot of mayors are working together and taking the best ideas from each other. There's an interesting organisation called C40, which works with mayors throughout cities throughout the world, in the developing world, in the developed world, in the US, in order to share best practice in dealing with air pollution as well as dealing with carbon emissions. And cities often, because they are working to a smaller constituent group, especially people who live in cities who are sharing the challenge of air pollution, it's easier for them to take more radical action often and move ahead in doing something to combat air pollution.
Let's take another call. A question from Jim in Salt Lake City. Jim, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Okay, so I've been looking into Utah's air pollution just kind of on my own. You know, I'm an amateur at all of this, but my understanding is, at least in the summer times, we get a fair amount of pollution coming across the ocean from China, and this is apparently a problem across all the West in the United States. And I'm just curious about how this issue generally is playing out internationally. I would imagine that the Paris Climate Accords have something to do with addressing it. But I'm curious about what this looks like on an international level.
Emily, what do you think?
So, sorry, the question about air pollution crossing borders. That's a very, very important one. And that's why, in a way, we need a lot more, you know, if air pollution is to be tackled effectively, there needs to be close collaboration between different countries. Because, of course, air pollution doesn't respect any borders. And a lot of the air pollution that we get in the UK also comes from Europe and vice versa. So I think it's a really interesting case of countries being able to talk to each other in order to share solutions. And I think also what's interesting is that China has really decided, I mean, partly because it's got a lot of political pressure inside the country, and I think partly because it wants to be seen as a pioneer and as a thought leader and a you know, leading activity, has done a lot of work in this space. And also, I talked to all sorts of interesting innovators on things like working on cleaner cook stoves, going off to conferences in China, you know, a lot of the time, because China wants to be ahead in this innovation space.
I was intrigued by a reference in one of the stories to the Chinese who have been experimenting with making rain to wash away pollution. What do you know about that?
I don't know too much about that. But again, when I was talking about those sorts of stories with academic colleagues who are specialists and who spend their life researching air pollution, they were pretty skeptical about them.
Here's a question from Mark. He says, lots of parents are putting these those filtering masks on their kids. On days like this, which I'll just tell you, Emily, it's really bad out there today in Salt Lake City. On days like this, do they do any good, those masks?
Well, yeah, I can totally understand why people want to put masks on. And there are also all these new, I've seen in one device on Kickstarter or some, you know, whereby that there is... you can put these filters either side of your child's head or in the car. Now, I think the research indicates that, you know, the more sophisticated the mask is, it will trap more pollution. But it's, again, one of the interesting things is about pollution is how localized it is. So that if you get away from those busy roads, if you get out your car, you can do a lot to protect yourself rather than just put a mask on. And also, it's pretty, you know, I mean, I don't cycle with a mask myself, but it doesn't mean it's not good. It does appear that masks can stop some types of air pollution. But again, that's about protecting an individual. It's not about dealing with a problem at source. And I don't feel we can all go around with masks all of the time. I mean, you know, and another thing that I think is really interesting when we're looking at air pollution, it's the behavior change that's really the toughest nut to crack. And it doesn't mean that we can't come up with better technology. And certainly, you know, all the technology which is making batteries and electric cars last much, much longer, then suddenly give many more people interest in buying an electric vehicle. But it's the behavior change which is the toughest nut to crack. And that's the same whether it's to do with people who drive cars or indeed people in developing parts of the world who are lighting fires, open fires, at which they're cooking with inside their own homes. So you've got millions of people around the world suffering really significant lung problems and the host of, you know, coronary and other illnesses and diseases and strokes because of cooking in their homes with these completely unsafe methods. And that's what the tradition is. And there can be a lot of pressure, for example, on women when they don't want to cook like that because people complain that the food doesn't taste so good.
You say in the series that one of the first steps in covering solutions is understanding exactly where the air is polluted and how individuals are affected. I wanted you to say something about the University of Leicester. Scientists there have been trying out these portable air monitors to get a really, it seems like a really precise sense of where this bad air is. Say something about that.
Measuring is really important because obviously in measuring, then we can be better, you know, the people who are solving this problem can be better at combating and really understanding where the worst problems are. So in Leicester, they've given like kids, because they want it to be on kid size, a kind of backpacks which can measure the pollution around them. We've also, in part of the season, we talked to guys who are using pigeons to be able to go at a very specific height in order to get and look at air pollution. And it's really important where on the roadside these monitors are, because of course, as I was saying, it really can vary between, you know, in a meter or so, the extent of air pollution. So getting very good measurement is important. And also my understanding is in the US, you know, they're using Internet of Things in order to measure air pollution and report back in real time and use that big data to analyze it and really figure out not only where, but at what times of the day is air pollution worse. And then that can really inform politicians when they're thinking about what measures to put in place in order to reduce air pollution where they are.
It's like crowdsourcing.
Yeah, it is like crowdsourcing. And there are also a number of innovative startups which are trying to use crowdsourcing and give all sorts of these very kind of relatively cheap monitors out to ordinary people, which can feed in. But they can measure some sources of pollutants and not others. But again, as the technology gets better and better, and some people are using, you know, things which you can, you know, use with your phone to measure air pollution and again to feed that information back in. And there are all sorts of host of different sorts of activities that people are doing. So it's really interesting to see what you guys decide to do in Utah.
It seems like technology must, you mentioned how these new devices to help in the fight against air pollution are coming onto the market all of the time. That must give you a sense of hope that the sense of innovation is really trying to work this out.
Yeah, it is, because it's, you know, affecting people. But there's also, you know, sort of technology which is enormous. Like they launched recently a new satellite, which is going to be taking, which is taking, I understand, 20 million observations every single day. It's called Sentinel SP, developed, I think, with Dutch technology, in order to be able to provide that really big sense of where air pollution is, as well as people using things like smell, because we don't see all air pollution. We've got some scientists doing smellscapes around a city in order to ascertain, because some pollutants are very smelly.
I love this part about smells. I mean, this growing scientific recognition about the power of our noses, and this is another crowdsourcing sort of solution. And in China, there's this team of smell specialists identifying pollutants in the air. This is pretty interesting.
It is interesting. And what, of course, also is interesting is that even, you know, perfumes and things that you use in your own home, like certain chemicals that you might use to clean your home, may also be creating air pollution. And we've changed that since I worked on the season. I'm just a bit more careful and I spend more time looking at those, you know, sort of things than I did in the past.
Another one of the questions that Mark asked is, where can I watch the BBC series on air pollution? And I'll tell you, Mark, we have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Emily Casriel is with us, head of editorial partnerships and special projects at the BBC World Service Group. We have a link to that reporting, as I said, on our website. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a quick break and come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This week on Radio West Films, we have the latest short in our series on Gerda Saunders. A few years ago, Gerda learned she had a progressive form of dementia, and she's allowed us to follow her on this journey. But this latest film is not about Gerda so much. It's about Peter, her husband of 46 years. Because at some inevitable point, the story always shifts away from the person with dementia to the person watching them live through it. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Emily Casriel. She's the head of editorial partnerships and special projects at the BBC World Service Group. Earlier this year, she served as editor of a number of stories about efforts around the world to deal with air pollution. That series is called So I Can Breathe. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. You can join us at 801-585-WEST. That's the number. Okay, back to the phones. Jen has been waiting in Salt Lake. Jen, hi.
Hi. I wanted to first mention a solution that has been effective here locally. One, it is here at the University of Utah, and there's a carrot and stick approach where all employees and students get free transit passes, and then they also have to pay for parking. So the combination of that has really been incredibly successful. You can imagine which of those is more popular, but together they really have made a substantial difference, but not all of our universities do that. And then I really wanted to thank you for the solutions-based journalism approach and really highlighting that. I think I've worked both as a professional and as a citizen advocate in the area of air quality here, and one thing we found is that so many people actually mistakenly think that the air pollution over the decades has gotten worse here in Salt Lake, when in fact, it, on average, it's gotten better. We do have these terrible episodes periodically, but all of the efforts and regulations have made a huge difference. And speaking of regulations, I think that also speaks to the fact that we tend to emphasize these individual choices rather than realizing that a good regulatory framework makes such a difference, and that we can be more creative with the right kinds of limitations. So, for example, catalytic converters being an example of something that came in. Nobody thought it could be achieved after the Clean Air Act amendments were put in, but in fact, our innovators came up with that. And we have such an anti-regulatory propaganda machine, quite honestly, in this country right now, that I think it's very important that we see that collectively that both personal behavior and regulations make a difference. I'm wondering if you see any of that impact on better support for a regulatory framework when people see that it actually works. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. Emily.
That's a really interesting question. And it's interesting that in the UK, most people perceive air pollution to be getting worse, when in fact, similar to what you're saying, it's happening in Utah and Salt Lake City, it's actually air pollution is decreasing in the UK. And not only that, that one of the things as part of our approach is that people often brandishing around that there's 40,000 air pollution related deaths every year. As a fact, whereas in fact that's a kind of model construct that is created with a lot of very complicated variables, and it's not 40,000 individual deaths. It's dependent on a lot, because you don't write air pollution on a death certificate, but depending on a lot of other variables. So certainly, telling the picture as it is rather than looking just for the bad story is really, really important. And I think people can feel encouraged that there are things that can be done. And I think because of the greater awareness about air pollution, and as I say, also because of the research that is being done in a whole host of medical areas about the impact of air pollution on our health in all sorts of ways, and on premature babies and on pregnancy and so forth, is making people feel that they're becoming a little bit more open to regulation, or at least some of them. And it obviously depends if you're going to be affected directly. If you've bought a diesel car because you thought that it was better for the environment, like a lot of people in the UK did, to then find that you are a pollutant, that doesn't feel good. And you might feel, and indeed many diesel car owners feel very angry about the potential of being penalised because of the vehicle that they bought in good faith, thinking that it was better for the environment.
We're pretty much out of time, but I wanted to ask you finally, do you think we're at a turning point in terms of our understanding about this, a kind of consciousness about the problem? What do you think?
I think there's a lot more awareness than it used to be. But I think that the thing about air pollution, there's not one cause of air pollution, and there's not one solution to air pollution. What works is a myriad of different solutions which impact the lots of variable types of air pollution that we've been talking about together on your show. And only through these very different approaches, not only in one city, not only in one country, but in many countries of the world, can air pollution effectively be tackled, and at the same time knowing how many natural causes of air pollution there are still.
Emily Casriel, she is with the BBC World Service Group, joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Emily, thanks very much for the time.
Great. It was really lovely to be with you all.
Thanks very much. Again, you can find a link to that series, So I Can Breathe, on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.